biological life form in there. If there's no radioactive gas erupted, then there is no biological substance in there. So, or at least a living substance, I should say. There's probably much better explanation out there than what I'm giving you, but the article is lacking in some of the details. Anyway, they performed the test, the first test. They scooped up the soil. They added the radioactive nutrients, and radioactive gas erupted. The second test, they heated the soil. They added the radioactive nutrients, and gas did not erupt. Therefore, many people thought at first that there was life on Mars. I'll drop it for now, and if you want me to go on, or if you want to comment, go ahead, K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yes, it did sound like a positive response, and we're going to have Paul discuss this since we come up to the space report. I vaguely remember that billions and billions, why can't I think of his name? Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan was heavily involved in that operation. And I thought he had concluded that the test was not positive. I don't think he, I don't remember him declaring, aha, Viking has discovered life on Mars. I don't remember that declaration. So maybe this test was repeated and they didn't get the same results the next time. And so it sounds to me a little bit like a PET scan. In the case of positron emission tomography, they inject a radioactive substance into your body, which is one of the nutrients the body is going to use. The muscles use the nutrient. The radioactive material gets deposited there. And then for the next hour or so, they look at the positron emissions, both the 0 and 180 degree points, in order to locate the where in your body is the absorption of the radioactive nutrient taking place. Let me drop it. I think the way the test works is that if all the muscles in your heart are working correctly, they're using the nutrient, and therefore they're going to see a fair amount of the stuff piling up there. Whereas if you have a blockage in the and that particular muscle of the heart is being starved, we'll see very little of the material being emitting from that area. So I'm guessing something of a slightly similar nature here was taking place. The biological life as it existed would be metabolizing the nutrient, sucking up the radioactive material, and therefore you could later boil it off and say, aha, the soil was doing absorption as if metabolism had been taking place. I think that's roughly what was going on. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet, you've got a John.
Very good explanation, Dick. And the exact words here in the article is radioactive nutrients were added to the Martian soil. A large amount of radioactive gas quickly erupted as if organisms had metabolized the nutrients. Duplicate soil samples were heated to kill these hypothetical microbes. Nutrients were then applied, and this time no gas emerged, as if heating had killed the micro-Martians. The conclusion was that Mars was teeming with life, but there was a contradictory indicator. The biological reaction was suspiciously pronounced, spiking way too fast and way too high. So there was some evidence that made people say, this doesn't look quite right. It goes on to say that perhaps there's a strange soil chemistry on Mars, and because the soil has been sterilized by, I'd have to scroll down here in the article, but perhaps it's been sterilized, and this is the reason for that. What the article doesn't say is why did that false flag emerge. There's a little bit more here if you want me to get into it, but I'm curious what you think about why that is, that there was this false indication of the metabolism. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Quickie question, N2MV.
documentary.
What is the possibility that they accidentally brought the nutrients with them? Because they probably wanted to sterilize the soil, but they didn't want to kill it.
Almost any spacecraft that we put on any of these planets, they do go through, and NASA goes through a pretty thorough sterilization procedure to make sure that we're not creating false alarms. So I don't think Viking brought that material with them. Now, the nasty thing about Mars, and one of the reasons why I'm not looking forward to an astronaut going there, is that it has essentially zero magnetic field. It's a smaller planet. The core has cooled off. It's no longer molten. No longer moving, not making a magnetic field. Without the magnetic field, you don't have a Van Allen belt. You have almost zero atmosphere. So when it comes to all of the solar wind and cosmic rays and everything else bombarding that surface is by solar radiation, by solar wind and the cosmic rays, that soil is continuously being sterilized. So for microbial life to survive on the surface of Mars, as I see it, it would be very difficult. And the sterilization, let me drop it. The sterilization that I just mentioned could easily be changing the soil chemistry such that this test gives a false positive. Now, could microbial life exist on Mars X number of meters down where it's being protected? And that's a tough one because periodically you get multiple hundreds of mile an hour winds, even though it's a very tenuous wind. You get some very high winds on Mars. And one of the flyby missions way back in the 70s or 80s looked at Mars and they saw a great big fuzzy ball because a great big dust storm had been taking place. And therefore very few surface features were able to be observed. So with those periodic very high winds, could you still have surviving microbial life below the surface that survived all this time is an interesting question. So Mars, I'm convinced Mars probably had life in the past. Did it get a chance to evolve far enough before all of these nasty changes took place on Mars is an interesting question. And could there be life there today? I think it's looking a bit doubtful. But when we get to the space report, we'll have Paul give a more thorough report on this one. I'll bet you he's been keeping track of this one, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW, and TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Yes, the article does go into everything you just said. They do go to great lengths to sanitize everything before it leaves. They bake everything and somehow seal that up before it gets there. That must be a very expensive procedure. I mean, look at a clean room, you know, how hard it is just to keep that completely unaffected by outside forces. Does say the most influential scientist on the team, of scientists on the team, including Norman Horowitz of the California Institute of Technology, leaned toward a non-biological explanation. Horowitz saw a planet with that water, organic or radiation, Mars with sterilized molecules that sterilize the surface in the same way that hydrogen peroxide can disinfect a cut in your skin. But again, the article still does not go into why this happened, so I'm looking forward to hearing more maybe at the space report. But very interesting. Yeah, it caught my attention this morning reading this when I woke up, and I thought, boy, that sounds like a good one for the crew over there at Lightmark. Very good. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
John, this article that you quoted to us, that article appeared where? What was the title of the article, and what journal was it in, John? Go ahead.
If you go to Washington Post and search their site and just type in Mars, it was was the first result for me when I typed in Mars. I read it on my Kindle, which I subscribed to the Washington Post, but to reread it tonight before the TechNet, I just went to Washington Post, typed in Mars, and there it was. The title of the article is, NASA's 1976 Viking mission to Mars did all that was hoped for it except find Martians.
Dick, since then, have they tried to look for any microbial life in any other way?
On the space report, we're going to ask Paul about that, but each of these missions to Mars, we've now had a number of Mars landers. Are they looking for life? Absolutely. They're using more and more exotic testing techniques, looking for past life, past water, past little beads of soil that show that water used to be there, and a lot of salt was there, and so on. So have they been looking for life? It's the main thing almost all of these Mars landers have been doing, from my point of view, Barry, and we're going to have Paul give us more information on that. We're a little bit late, but we're going to go over to the mailbag, and we'll discuss anything except waveguide. I'm having some fun with John, KC2WGB. What kind of tough questions they're going to ask us this week, John, K2RIW, the TechNet?
I'd like to make a final comment on the Mars thing.
Go ahead, John.
There was a bit of contradicting information in this article, and I realize Washington Post isn't a scientific journal, but it does say when rovers tunnel across Mars today, they do not carry any life detection instruments. That's not because of a presumption that Mars is sterile, but because Viking showed that scientific questions have to be framed very carefully. So perhaps they don't know, they don't want to put the money into something they don't fully understand. That may be the clue right there. Viking's error might be described as a scientific overreach, the article claims. K2RIW, KC2SHS.
The reason that we haven't found the Martians yet is they don't want us to find them yet, WJ2.
Yeah, they're hiding behind those rocks, though, Joe.
No, I'm convinced that they're now not looking for the life directly. They're looking for evidence of past life. They're looking for the characteristics that would have been required. Life, as we know it, requires water. So there's a lot of the Martian rovers right now are looking for evidence of past water. And looking at the way the rocks have formed and the way the sediments of a lake have formed and so on. So the raw ingredients that are required for life to persist are being pursued now, is my way of looking at it. But we'll soon have Paul give us a better description. KC2WGB, what are this week's questions like, John? K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. All right, well, it's been a slow week. I guess the beautiful weather, everybody's out doing interesting things. But I do have a question here that maybe you have an answer for this gentleman. He's questioning the element quartz as an RF shield, a Faraday element. You know, possibly if a quartz layer could produce a Faraday cage, will RF pass through quartz? Maybe you have some information on that, Dick. This will help him out with his studies. Back to you, Dick.
If I had some kind of an RF circuit that I wanted to shield from the outside world, or if that RF circuit is emitting, I know I shield the outside world from it, I'm going to build a Faraday cage around it. And the Faraday cage is either going to be spherical or it's going to be cubic. It could be a six-sided cube. And a Faraday shield almost always consists of highly conductive material.
you to make a shield out of dielectric material, I think is out of the question. Quartz, my understanding of quartz is it's not a conductive material, like copper and silver and aluminum, steel. Quartz is a piezoelectric material. It makes very nice crystal oscillators, but you could put your ohm meter across a chunk of quartz, and you would measure essentially an open circuit. Since it's non-conductive, I don't think you can make a shield out of it. That's my first impression on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2IW, the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick, yeah, well, that sounds reasonable. Now, the reason he asked that is he was reading some information about a Russian project. They were going to build something like NORAD in a mountain in Russia. But they found out that after tunneling through that they could not communicate because of the quantity of quartz, which is what was written. And I wasn't sure. I've never done any experiments with that. But I believe what you're telling me is true. But there must have been some other thing that was causing the problem. Or maybe it's just a figment of their imagination. All right. I'll let it drop and go on to my next question.
Yeah, let me add some words to this one. When you and I are building a Faraday shield, we're likely to build it out of material that is, let me pick a number, a 16th of an inch thick. And therefore, I want it to be a highly conductive material, and I'm going to probably make the equivalent of a six-sided box around the thing that I want shielded. Whereas if I'm building something like NORAD, and I'm burying miles into the hillside, if quartz is in that hillside and it's a mile thick, that's very different. So, what you think is an insulated material, but it's a mile of it, cannot disturb radio signals that you want to flow through that soil. I can see how they definitely could. You and I don't build a Faraday shield a mile thick, so it's a peculiar comparison, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. But if I wanted to communicate from inside of a hillside, I would put some transmission lines between the inside and the antennas that I've got on the outside. It's very difficult to transmit long-range signals underground. Yes, it is done in case the command receiver that's on a nuclear submarine. I think they only got to come up to something like 60, within 60 feet of the surface, and they can communicate at VLF frequencies at a very slow rate, but you can get the message through worldwide. So if you can transmit through seawater, but even the seawater you're transmitting through, I think you're only transmitting through 60 feet of it. If that submarine was 1,000 feet down, I don't think you can communicate with it anymore by radio means. So to communicate from inside of a mountain, I'd want to use a transmission line to do it. I wouldn't try to depend on sending the radio signal through the mountain, but maybe I'm misunderstanding the situation. KC2WGB, K2LAW, the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. No, I believe you have it right, Dick. I'm interpreting it the same way you are. So, well, maybe he'll read more about it, and I'll get some more information on it. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my next question. Okay, this young gentleman has a question about moon bounce, and I know Barry's in there. Maybe he knows, too. He's working at 400 megahertz. He has a 15-element Yagi. But he only has 100 watts, and he wanted to know, do you think it's possible that he might be able to hear a signal coming back to him with a couple of seconds delay with only 100 watts and one antenna? What do you think of the possibility of that? Maybe you can give him some tips. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to be turning this over to Barry. However, the articles I've been reading lately tell me that if you're using WSAT, weak signal Joe Taylor techniques, these digital techniques. Can 100 watts and a 15 element Yagi do it? I think the answer is yes, particularly when you're talking to the big guns. That can do it. It has been done. It's sort of the bottom of the capability, but people have done it. Unfortunately, the first time somebody does moonbound, you'd like to press down the key, go to the receive mode, hear the echo come back as a tone in your earphone. With 100 watts and one Yaki, you're not going to hear that tone. You drop it. You could say that for the human hearing system to hear that tone in the noise, you need something close to 0 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, maybe minus 5. Whereas the weak signal Joe Taylor techniques, the digital techniques, can dig down as deep as 28 dB below the noise. And it will write a message across your screen on your computer. The WSJT program will do that for you. Your ear will hear that signal that the computer is processing, and you'll say, I didn't hear a thing. There's nothing there but noise. So, moonbound, the most pleasurable part of moonbound is pressing down the key, and 2.5 seconds later, hearing your CW tone come back from the moon. To do that requires more like 8 Yagis, and more like 500 watts, and a good day, the right day at the perigee, and during the time you've got a good low noise front end, and the moon is in the direction where the sky is not making a lot of noise. It's not the center of the galaxy. Let me drop it. In that condition that I just described, 8 or so Yagis, 500 watts, at least 8 Yagis and at least 500 watts, on a good day, 50% probability, you will hear your tone in the noise. And you send Morse code, and you might even recognize your call that is coming back. So, for a guy to be pleased that he sees the message across the screen when he's running a schedule with another digital guy who's running a lot of equipment on his end, it's not quite as pleasurable. The thing that we amateurs do is we communicate. We trade ideas back and forth. That's what's been going on for 32 years on the TechNet. In the case of threshold moonbound, let me drop this. When you're using bare minimum, bare bones moonbound, you're able to, by way of the computer program and what's written across the screen, say, yes, I recognize those call letters. Yes, I recognize that signal strength report. Thank you for the QSO, please send me a card. And you collect a number of these cards worldwide. But to keep up the enthusiasm when you're not really talking to somebody, that's not so easy. So, it takes more equipment to do it such that you can hear it. And they've made some recent changes over the last decade or so as to what is considered a valid QSO. More than a decade ago, before the digital techniques came along, let me drop it. A valid QSO, by gentleman's agreement, consisted of a man sitting in front of his equipment at one sitting event. He didn't get half the call letters today and half the call letters tomorrow. At one sitting event, with his human hearing, he heard a full set of call letters, an unknown piece of information like signal strength report, passed in both directions, and Rogers in both directions, saying that the information, the two pieces of information, were received both ways. That was a valid QSO. And there was quite a bit of controversy when the digital techniques came along, and a human being wasn't doing it. And so the people who spent 15 years getting 47 states by moonbound on 432. It took them 15 years to do that, hard work, and along comes the digital techniques, and the guy can do that in 2 months. They thought that was, they think that was unfair. My suggestion, and I didn't take it, was that there should be two separate lists. The list of the guys who have worked X number of states by moonbound by way of a human intervention, and the second list was the guys who did it with digital techniques. Because they're so darn different, there should be two separate lists to keep it fair, as I see it. KC2WGB, K2RIW, drag your feet in case Barry, N2 Moonbound, wants to give us his words on this. You've got it, John, with some delay.
Okay, I'll take it up for a second. I kind of agree with Dick that one of the problems that I found with WSKT, I think it's a valid vote, and I think it's fair. And yes, you can do it, as Dick said, with very low power. That's the good news. The bad news is that you have to know what the guy is sending you. You can't have him send you something out of the blue, something random. You have no way to detect that. So that was my argument with WSKT, that it wasn't valid because you had to know what the guy was going to send before he sent it. I didn't care for that. If they can develop it to the point where you have no clue what he's going to send, and he can send you all kinds of stuff, and then you can say, yep, I got that, that would, in my opinion, be a fair contact. But there's nothing wrong with WSJT. It's just that it has to be a little more refined for me to accept it. That's all. As far as what Dick said about the CW communications and things like that, absolutely right. He doesn't have enough antenna and enough power to make that contact. If he had a big antenna, like I had some big antennas, he could do it with 100 watts. He could definitely do it with 100 watts. He's going to need a bigger antenna. And 2 MB, standing by.
To be with a quick pass. Go ahead, Joe, and then I'm going to add some words.
The same lines, anybody that's interested in working, something in outer space, the SO-50 is completely operational right now, and it's very easy to work. It runs analog FM. You go up on 145, something, I believe, I forget what the frequency is. A 2 meter frequency up and a UHF frequency down. All you need is a handheld arrow antenna. It has 3 elements on 2 meters, 7 elements on 440, and you can work that with a couple of HDs. You have 1 HD up to, transmit on 2, 1 HD to receive on UHF, and you can just point the antenna at the satellite when it's coming over. Use one of the programs that predict where it's going to be, and you can hear yourself come back and make use of those and confirm contacts, and that's a fairly inexpensive, easy way to work a space entity, a satellite. That's a lot of fun, WJ.
There will be a fair amount of satellite work taking place at the field day next weekend. I know for a fact that the Great South Bay Club, their actual operating site, I think, is in Lindenhurst. They will be doing moonbound stuff. Bill, WB2QGZ, is working on that project right now to set up equipment to do satellite work during the field day. So somebody visiting that field day site will have a chance to see it in operation. Barry, you said that you know what the guy's going to send. One possible interpretation of those words, let me drop it, is that the digital communication is highly formatted. That the format is your call letters, his call letters, signal strength report, over. And that's sent back and forth in both directions. And when that data is received successfully in one direction, then call letters and rogers are sent. So it is highly formatted as to what information is sent when. Is that what you mean by you know exactly what's going to be sent? When you know what nature of data in the format, in what period of time? You, don't know whether or not he's going to give you an S2 or an S4 signal strength report. And in theory, you weren't absolutely positive what call letters are going to be sent until they appeared on your screen. So there are two pieces of unknown information that does get transmitted. But by your and my normal standards, that's not much of a conversation. Add some words to this one, Barry. N2 Moonbounce, K2LAW.
I think the computer clocks have to be perfectly synchronized. Also, you have to know exactly when it's coming to be chased.
Yeah, Jake. No, it's a little more than that. The problem is that your computer, or whatever you're using, has the call letters in it. And the signal coming in doesn't even have to give you all the call letters. It just has to match them a little bit. And it says, yep, that's the call letters. And it goes on to the next format. And everything is canned. In other words, your computer has what is to be said in it. So it doesn't have to match it 100%. It just has to match it a little bit. And that's not random. I want random. In other words, he doesn't know what you're going to send. And you say, oh, that's what he sent. That, to me, is a real concept. This is not quite there yet.
So when it comes to the super weak reception capability of digital techniques, what I think you're telling us is that all the known moon bouncers are on a list that's built into the computer. And maybe the list is 400 names long, 400 call letters long. And so if it receives enough of the call that there is no longer any ambiguity among the 400 candidates that are known moonbound operators that are in that list. And so in the case of N2MB, if I got N2M and I didn't get the B, but there's, of the 400 candidates, nobody else is a November 2 Mike something something. Therefore, it says, aha, that had to be Barry. And so, if a brand new guy came out of the woodwork and he's not on the list, he might not be properly recognized. I think that's part of what you're saying, Barry. N2MB, K2LAW.
A little worse than that, when you make the contact, I'm putting in N2EO. That's what's in my computer. So if N2MB sends a signal, it's going to say that's N2EO, because that's what it's told to call it. So it's still a little too vague. I think they have to do a little better for me to consider it real communication.
Now, this is the super threshold stuff at minus 28 signal-to-noise ratio. If I was sitting at minus 5 signal-to-noise ratio, because I'm talking to a big gun, these automatic selection techniques might not be required, and the possibility exists that real communication could take place. Is that somewhat true, Eric? I mean, Barry? Or is the format so tight that I can't send anything but call letters and signal strength and Rogers? N2MB, K2LAW.
I have to go back and look at it. I was under the impression you couldn't deviate from the format. I think it might be possible if you have good strong signals, and you wouldn't even need that technique, actually, you could send a surprise sentence or a surprise word. I think. But I haven't been able to prove that. I would have to go back to him and ask if that's possible.
Okay, very fine, Barry. So we're learning more and more about the current techniques being used by moonbounce. Obviously, for 35 continuous years, K2UIH, K2 Uniform Yankee Hotel, it used to be called Trenton State Teachers College. It's now got the Technical College of New Jersey, I think it's called, something like that. And Alan Sock is the guy. He has been printing this monthly journal for the Moonbounce people for 35 solid years. So by on his mailing list or going to the website where you can read the past information. Each one of his lunar monthly journals contains about 6 or 7 pages. Good diagrams, good technical data. Each individual guy who gives him the sickle report gives him a whole lot of information. So you look at the past issues of the EME News of K2UIH at Trenton College. And boy, is there a lot of information. There's a website where you can look at all of those past 35 years. There's a mountain of information there. So if anybody wants to know the last word and all the controversies and non-controversies of Moonbound, that's the place to go. KC2WTB, K2IW in the TechNet. I may have said Alan Sock, it's Alan Katz. Alan Katz is the name. K2 Uniform Yankee Hotel. Over to you, John.
KC2WGB. Well, good moon bounce information. Very good. So 100 watts is possible, but he will need a better antenna system. All right. Maybe he can arrange that. All right. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my last question. Okay, Dick. This gentleman here has a question about radar. And his question is, if you're flying in your aircraft and you're watching your radar, and you're over terrain, you know, hills and towers and structures, and you have that clutter on the radar, and you're, say, at 5,000 feet, and there's another craft that's down at 500 feet, the radar will recognize, will definitely see a signal from it, but how does he tell the difference between the, all that ground clutter and that particular radar cross-section he's interested in? Do they use specific frequencies to get a better resolution for a smaller craft, or is it basically the same frequency and somehow that's interpreted? So maybe you've got an understanding of what he's asking. Over to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
There are zillions of different kinds of radar, but one of the more effective airborne radars is one that's using Doppler. In other words, it knows how fast it is moving. Therefore, it knows how fast the terrain is moving compared to the aircraft. It knows exactly what Doppler shift is coming back from that terrain echo. That other aircraft is flying below you. He does not move at the same speed as the terrain. He's either moving toward you or away from you or left and right compared to you. He's moving in some other velocity, in some other direction compared to the terrain. So a moving target indicator, that's what they call an MTI. The general class of Doppler-sensitive radars are called moving target indicators. And one that's properly programmed can know that each portion of the ground clutter, it knows to reject it because it's coming back at a very specific Doppler shift. Therefore, you know it's clutter and it's not the aircraft you're looking for. Then again, you can set the radar differently so that it shows the clutter. Let me drop it. The aperture synthesis radar, which has a very long antenna along the length of the fuselage of the airplane, and it looks off to the side, to the left and the right of the airplane. And that's using all the techniques of time delay, amplitude, Doppler shift, and aperture synthesis. In other words, that array, that antenna on that airplane, even though the antenna might be 30 feet long from front to back, it acts like a 300-foot long antenna and gives a very high angular resolution. The picture you get off of that radar to the left and the right, the side view picture you get, is essentially a photograph. But that photograph doesn't get interfered with by rain clouds. It looks right through those clouds and looks at all the terrain. So there's all kinds of radars. that can give you resolution of a specific target. Let me drop. One of the most exciting radars that I worked on very briefly is called the TIPS-5, TPS-5, AN/PPS-5, was a Ku-band radar, MANPAC radar used in Vietnam, and it was very Doppler sensitive. It was a non-coherent Doppler radar, which you climb into your foxhole so you're safe, but on the tripod outside of the foxhole is this Ku-band dish antenna, which is a bat wing, oh, about a foot and a half wide and half a foot high, and it's on this tripod and it's waving back and forth and it's transmitting pulses into the woods that's in front of you. And for roughly 3 kilometers into that woods, it'll only give you a response on the screen of things that are moving. And the things that are moving don't have to be moving very fast. A man walking, a female walking, gives a very specific Doppler shift signal to a Ku-band radar. Let me drop this. And you can display the target range and azimuth on the screen. You can also listen to the echo of the target with a set of earphones. And there's a very specific set of sounds you get of the Doppler shift of the moving vehicle, whether it be a vehicle with wheels, a vehicle with a tracked vehicle, you know, like a tank, a man walking or a female walking. There is a belief, I'm not completely sure it's absolutely true, but that a highly trained operator could tell the difference between a female walking and a male walking, because different portions of the body move slightly differently and make slightly different tones. So you can train a radar, you can design a radar to look for very specific kinds of targets that have very specific characteristics, and therefore you can differentiate from all of those trees that are in that woods. You don't see the trees, you only see the moving things that are in that woods. And so something as far as 3 kilometers away from you that's moving toward you, you have 3 kilometers worth of forewarning. You better get ready because something's coming in from the north and you hope it's friendly. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That must have been a very nice instrument to work on. Very, very useful, too. I mean, be able to tell a tank, I can see that, it's a pretty large object, but for a talented operator to be able to tell the difference between a man and a woman, that's interesting. Also, you know, a dog or small animal, good stuff. Oh, by the way, Dick, the question on that Mars sampler, if I remember the story, the scooper that makes the dig goes into a chamber that heats up. They heated the scoop before it went into the soil, so it was sterilized. I don't think it could have brought anything to the soil. So I believe that that's how they handle that. So we'll go over to Paul and see what information he's got. That's it from the Space Report. I want to thank everybody for sending the questions, and maybe some more will come in for next week. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. Okay, we're about to hear Space Report number 206 of the series by Paul, our space expert. And you may have heard, Paul, that a second LIGO detection took place in the last week or so. In other words, two more black holes zipped around each other, made a chirping sound, and then collided and lit up the detectors on the LIGO, on the two LIGO detectors. So it's not just a fluke. And I think the scientists are predicting what once LIGO gets into its next phase of more sensitivity, I think they're predicting they're going to be getting a detection like every month or every few weeks. Because somewhere in the universe, there are black holes that are coming together. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a poll.
This is WS2N. Yeah, I did read a day or two ago about the LIGO report. So that's good. What I read it was a very much would have been much harder to attack normally. First one was very strong that they got, and this one is very light, and they expect the other ones to be very, very weak like this too. So they started off with a strong one, but I did play the audio back. It sounds like a quick chirp when they raised the frequency. I was on the lower frequency. I don't know. I couldn't hear it. I put the volume up. I didn't hear it. But I heard it when they changed it to the higher frequency. So hopefully they'll do more with that. You know, they have the LISA Pathfinder. I know I went over that last week. Space-borne LIGO type of detectors that are now out at the L1 position, a million miles from Earth, in the direction of the sun. Floating free with spacecraft surrounding it so that they can't be affected by cosmic winds or anything. Let me drop it. And they wanted it to test to see if that was feasible, and it came out five times better than they thought originally. NASA was involved. Launched by the European Space Agency by a Vega rocket, came out of Kourou, French Guiana. That's where it was launched. And now, because of that, maybe 10-15 years from now, they plan on having the same type of thing. They'll have three of these spacecraft. You know, this flight was a proof of concept, and then 2030. Plan on having these things millions of miles apart, three of them communicating with one another, and then if a gravitational wave goes by, they'll be able to detect them, and they'll probably, you know, they expect it to be much more sensitive than the LIGO here on Earth. But so that you know, that bodes well for those programs, because a year or so ago when the first LISA Pathfinder was launched, the results from the first LIGO report wasn't even in yet. So since that came in, and now a second one came in that you mentioned, that's really good. Okay, a few things going on in the rocket world. The Cygnus spacecraft has unberthed from the International Space Station, and that's on the way back to burn up over the Pacific Ocean. That happened last week, and that has on board the, they call it the Safe Fire Experiment number one, about the size of a suitcase, and it was attached to the wall of the Cygnus spacecraft. The Cygnus spacecraft, anybody that doesn't know, is a cargo vehicle that is launched by Orbital ATK, and it was launched in this case on an Atlas V rocket from Florida, and it docked with the space station many months ago, about 3 months ago, and they unloaded some 7,000 pounds worth of material and clothes, experiments to the space station, and over the months they put about 4,000 pounds back in for trash, and now they use the Cygnus for experiments. The next couple of Cygnus cargo vehicles that go up are going to have the Safe Fire 2, Safe Fire 3. They want to test the fire protection systems that would be needed if they're going to need to go to Mars or back to the moon. They need to see what happens in zero-G on a large scale, instead of just, you know, lighting off something the size of a matchbook inside of a controlled piece of test equipment on board the ISS. attached to the space station, is disconnected from the space station, runs this safe fire experiment, and now it's launching CubeSats that were attached to the to Cygnus. So again, there with all the different cargo vehicles going up, you have SpaceX coming back. This thing now flying around, its own test satellite before it burns up into the Pacific. Basically, just disconnect. A couple hours later, burn up. Now they'll fly these things for a week or so before they burn them up. So I thought that was pretty good. Let me drop it. This morning, around 10:30 or so, they had live on some of the websites. Blue Origin is a company that's building the new Shepard, and their idea is to send people into suborbital space for now, and eventually they'll be paying crew, passengers with a crew, well, one or two pilots on board, and the idea is to go into suborbital space in Texas. They launch from Texas, and this is the fourth time they did this successfully with this rocket called the New Shepard, and it gets up to past the Kármán line, which is 62 miles up, so that qualifies as space. It separates the capsule from the booster. The booster comes down vertically, lands back to where it took off from, and they've done that now successfully fourth time. The crew capsule, they wanted to see what would happen if a parachute failed. It normally comes down on three parachutes. Here they disconnected one altogether. Let's see what happens. And it worked perfectly. It came back. And if you were an astronaut sitting inside this thing, you wouldn't have known the difference when it landed. And at the last second, they have retro rockets that fire. You also saw it. Landing. So I watched that live. It's the first time that Blue Origin had it live. Usually they're pretty secretive, but now they're carrying missions, missions from different companies that want to test different things, including NASA. NASA signed up with them to run.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
To broadcast this live every time they do this, I would imagine. So they're getting there. Eventually they plan on having a much bigger spacecraft to go orbital, and that won't be launched from Texas anymore. That will be launched from Launch Complex 36 that they took over down in Florida last year. So they're going to rebuild that for their needs of their future spacecraft and rocket. Okay, let's see, another returnable rocket story was SpaceX. SpaceX last week launched two more satellites to geosynchronous orbit, and they're doing one flight after the other. I mean, they're going like every 3 weeks now. They're putting a rocket up, and this was for two communication satellites, and they had these two, I believe, had the ion rockets on board. So once they get to a geosynchronous transfer orbit, they'll use the ion rockets to eventually get themselves to where they want to be. SpaceX wanted to land their booster back onto the drone ship, the ASTAS, they call the Autonomous Spaceport Drone Ship, which he named, of course, I Still Love You is the name of the ship, floating 400 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean. And this one came down a little hard, so it did come down. I did watch it. and came down a little hard and collapsed all the engines in a vertical landing. So unfortunately, they weren't able to save it. Still considered experimental, so they're happy to get the data back. They've done pretty good. They've done four landings in a row. This would have been another one. So we'll see what happens next time around. They plan on a couple of weeks from now. I think they're going to be sending up a cargo ship to the International Space Station, and that will be a landing back on land, like they did the first time successfully. Landed one right back at Cape Canaveral. They have their own, they call it Landing Zone 1. They took over Launch Complex 13 for landing. The years they've taken over Launch Complex 41, correction, Launch Complex 40 for all their rockets that they launched, Falcon 9 rockets. And in this November, hopefully November, they'll be utilizing their other launch complex that they took over, Launch Complex 39A. There's a 39A and 39B. Well, they took over 39A. That's the one that used to launch a lot of the shuttles and the Saturn V years ago. So now that they have it, and that's what they'll be launching the Falcon 9 Heavy from. So that's going to be real neat when they do that. And that's pretty much it. I'm looking forward to, I know I've talked about it before, so I won't go on and on about it. The Juno mission, that's going to go into polar orbit. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. That's going to be in orbit around Jupiter on July 4th. So that's good planning. I like that. And we'll have to see how that goes. That thing is big as a couple of buses put together. I guess it's about 120 feet long. Solar panel to solar, you know, solar panel in to solar panel. And it's a big spacecraft. It'll have to fire a rocket for a half hour to slow itself down to get itself to a orbit. It'll go over the top first, over the north, and then over the south, and then on a very elongated flight from about July 4th. That was one of the plans on land. You talked about biking before. That was a planned landing date for July 4th, but it didn't come off. The reason for it was there was a landing at the time. Scientists wanted one particular landing, engineers kind of wanted another. One of them wanted 40 degrees north, or a little long, you know, further than that. And they decided not to do that. Where they wanted to land was risky enough. They just didn't want to have a crash on July 4th. So they held off and deorbited 16 days later, and that's why it was the tail end of the month when the Vikings went down. The Vikings did have it was combination flights. There were two Viking missions launched to Mars a couple weeks apart. And one, it was a Viking 1 and Viking 2, so each one had its own orbiter. But they didn't have any relay stations like we do today. We have Mars Odyssey and Mars Global Surveyor up there. We use them as repeaters for the ground landing rovers that are down there. We didn't have that back.